Hello, hello, hello. Thank you for tuning in to yet another episode of Justice League Revisited, the show that dives into the depths of your favorite animated series starring your favorite animated superheroes. Once again, I'm joined, as always, by my wonderful co-host, one of those seven superheroes, the voice of Wonder Woman, Susan Eisenberg. How are you?
I'm well and happy as always to be here with you, and happy to be doing this interview because I, as much as I hate the fact that I'm not in this episode, kept looking for me. Where is she? I loved watching this and I'm so excited to talk to our guest today.
I know the other person absent from this episode was Michael Rosenbaum's The Flash.
Yeah.
So I always give a backstory in my head as I'm watching it. So I figured Wonder Woman is giving Flash dating advice. That's why they're not in this episode. She's kind of helping him out because he struggles with the ladies.
I cannot imagine I'd have the I meant she would have the patience for that. I just can't imagine. But it's a lovely thought.
Thank
it's
you.
A lovely thought. Okay.
Always try
I'll
to come
buy
up
it.
With that.
Thanks.
For those of you who are tuning in, Metamorphosis is the episode we'll be covering, our introduction in the DC Animated Universe to Rex Mason, a.k.a. the superhero known as Metamorpho. This is the 11th story in the first season of Justice League. It is actually episodes 22 and 23, respectively. The director of this was the great Dan Reba. Writer is our guest, Len Yulee, and the teleplay was by Dwayne McDuffie. We'll have to ask Len about that, the teleplay versus the writing going forward, but that's a great pedigree right there. And of course, great cast. Earl Bowen played Simon Stagg. Richard Mall, who voiced Two-Face in Batman the Animated Series, plays Java. Tom Sizemore, big actor. I mean, come on. Metamorpho himself, Rex Mason. And Danica McKellar plays Star... I said Star Sapphire. That's a villain. Sapphire Stagg.
I know, it's so funny because I was like, don't say Star Sapphire. Don't say Star... I thought the same thing. Okay, Sapphire Stagg.
Yes. But great, once again, I mean, it's never not a good cast because the voice casting by Andrea and the people that Bruce Timm would bring in for this, always top shelf.
Beyond. And I got to say, Earl Bowen, I mean, how many credits did that man have? How many things did we see him in? And to think he was on our animated show, it's really, wow. I don't think anyone said no to Andrea Romano. I don't think anyone did.
One of my favorite GIFs out there, GIF, the motion little picture, is of Earl Bowen from Terminator 2 when the cigarette's dangling out of his mouth as the T-1000 walks through the bars in his liquid form and the cigarette drops out. And I've seen it interplayed with a small kitten walking through bars and he's staring at the kitten and the cat.
Really?
Yeah, but there's all sorts of variations of the GIF file, which is GIF file. I don't need to say file at the end, but the point is,
I know that,
yes.
That's a little geeky even for you.
Sorry about
that.
To say GIF
file. Yeah.
But yeah, just it's such a great actor.
Such a great actor. And so, you know, I mean, we'll hear about the script. We'll hear about Len's origin story. We'll hear it all, folks. So stay tuned, right? Because this is going to be a good one, I think.
I'm very excited for this episode. So bringing him in, Len Yulee, the guy who wrote this two-parter we're talking about, Metamorphosis, from October of 2002. It's hard to believe it's been over 20 years since this came out. Len, welcome to the show.
Thank you for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be here. I've heard many of your interviews with so many of my colleagues, and you've set a high bar, which I will trip over at my earliest opportunity, I'm sure.
Well, welcome. It's always a pleasure to have the writers, because so many of the fans know the names, but they rarely get an opportunity to meet them and hear their stories. So thank you so much for joining us. This is a treat for us.
Well, it's a treat for me, too. Thank you. Because, you know, like most writers, I sit alone in my room a lot. So, you know,
welcome.
Anybody that wants to chat is already on my happy list.
Oh,
perfect.
That's great.
Well, I must be a writer because I sit alone in my room a lot of times, too. Who knew that I was a writer?
That's a different episode. Okay, James?
Yeah, that's true.
A different episode.
When we get to the Dr. Destiny one, we'll talk more.
Thank you.
With writing this, so we love the revisit. Obviously, that's part of the name of the show, Justice League Revisited. So we'll start right out of the gate, Len. When you rewatched this two-parter, what were some of the things that initially struck you about it?
Well, the first thing was how well made it was, mm-hmm. how well directed it was.
Yes.
Ken Reba, one of my favorite directors to ever work on anything I've ever written. We worked a lot over the years on one show or another, particularly on the Ben 10 series many years later. And, you know, it's just terrific work. And, of course, all of Bruce Timm's production team, you know, they're at the top of their game there. And so watching it again, it was like, oh, yeah, that was a good episode. So, I, you know, had nothing to do with me, but what they did was really terrific. And they just hit all the marks. So that was the first impression I got. And then, of course, I listened to the, you know, the dialogue and what was mine and what was, you know, by other people. And, you know, the usual collaboration thing, but all in a very positive experience. So thanks for the reminder, actually.
Yeah, that's one of the things we love.
I think before we go further, we really do need to address the elephant in the room, which is, why wasn't Wonder Woman in this episode?
Yeah, doggone it. Why? I have no
idea.
Why? Why?
Why?
You know, that's, I may be misremembering, and I apologize if this is an error. But I think there was the kind of thing in the order in which these things were made, and again, this is lost in the mists of time, but I got the feeling that there was like, oh, well, we have to sort of trade out characters one from the other so that and as you know, you can't pack everybody into an episode because you need to be able to service them. Like William Goldman says in his book, you know, always protect your hero, always protect your star. And so if we have too many people just standing around, it doesn't really provide anything for any of them, really. Everybody gets a little cheated. So, yes, I would have loved to have written for your Wonder Woman. I didn't get the chance, doggone it, and we'll get into the timing of all of this later. But, yeah, it was a missed opportunity, and I apologize for that, even though I had nothing to do with it.
And actually, we've discussed this with other people, and that was just the reality of doing a show with so many cast members, just like live action. I mean, you're not going to have them each and every week. You're going to have people sit out and be on the bench and then call them up. So I understand. Ish, yeah. But I just had to I just had to mention it because I didn't remember this episode, and I was watching the first part and I was like, okay, fair enough, she's not here, that's fine, I'm sure she'll be in the second episode the second part, and then it was like, no she's not. Womp womp.
And it also missing dark. Flash in this one too.
Yeah, and I would have been thrilled to write for Michael on that.
Yes.
But no, yeah. It's just, you know, what can I say? It was a very deep bench. They had so many wonderful performers on this show, you know, some of whom I've had the chance to work with many times, like Phil Lamar, and others, you know, only a couple of times, you know, like the late lamented Batman. But I let's not get emotional here. But I mean, it's there are so many wonderful people here, and had I had the opportunity to work on other episodes, it would have been a thrill, you know, but stuff happens
while you're dropping names. I just want to point out, and it made me very sad to realize this, because it's got a great cast. We have Sapphire Stagg, played by Danica McKellar, who went on to do Young Justice as well. But when I looked at this made me very sad. Simon Stagg was played by Earl Bowen. Java was played by Richard Mall. Metamorpho by Tom Sizemore. Dang it, we lost all three of those people in 2023. And that, I cannot believe that amount of talent went out the door last year. That is mind-boggling.
I hope you're not making me responsible for any of those.
No.
Because,
because I would feel very badly. Yes. Again, now we're talking about Andrea Romano, who was the most extraordinary director, and who cast these characters and brought in all of these wonderful, wonderful people. And so, you know, every time, if you were fortunate enough to be able to attend any of the recording sessions, you would come in and you'd say, oh, look, there's somebody I've grown up watching. Oh, look, there's a movie star. And somehow or another, they were integrated brilliantly by Andrea and her talents and skills in with this extraordinary cast. So, I mean, it was just, there was no way you could walk away from this saying, well, it could have been better. No, it was almost wonderful What a treat. And, you know, for writers like myself, particularly those of us who, you know, are freelancers, to be able to see a show that you've written performed at this level, it's just extraordinary. It's like it's our version of opening night. Curtain up, behind the glass, there are all these people, mm-hmm. and they're doing, saying your words, making them better. You know, and Andrea, who could always find subtext that you didn't know you'd written. I know, it's what a gift, mm-hmm. right? So if you're going to be a writer in any medium and you get to see your words put on screen or on a stage, and then it's something of this quality, well, you know, it's worth the price of admission, you know?
It was such an impressive cast. And James, like you, I mean, I immediately, you know, I knew all the actors. I knew their names. I recognized them. But yeah, you're right. It's stunning that we lost them. And I have to say a special shout out to Danica, because I never would have guessed that was her. You know, so many actors, right? You can hear them, including myself. You can hear me in there. I had forgotten. I looked it up and I was like, that is extraordinary. She was wonderful, yes. Wonderful, and brought so many layers to that, because at first you see her and you're like, oh, kind of a bimbo, whatever. And then you realize she is this loving, loyal, wonderful woman.
And not all of that, and smart and passionate.
Yes.
And, yeah, just terrific. And feisty, you know.
Yes.
You know, she wasn't just a damsel in distress, though. Right. Eventually, there was a certain amount of distress involved. But I mean, yeah, it was a wonderful performance by her. I got a chance to work with her on Static Shock, mm-hmm. and that was a pleasure, because she's a lovely person and a fine actress. And again, it's so amazing to look back at these episodes and see, you know, who passed through. Not to mention, you know, the extraordinary ensemble.
Yeah, no, it's always a great voice cast. And every time I look back, I go, oh, wow. Like, even little things like we had the old guard. Michael Bell was on this one playing the National Safety yes. Transportation Bureau. And I hear that voice and I'm like, oh, it's Prowl from Transformers or Duke from G.I. Joe. Because that's Michael Bell's one of those old school, old guard, hardcore voice actors that just that voice resonates every time I hear it, whether he's more soft like this or if he's more commanding like Duke from G.I. Joe. D. Bradley Baker was the synthoid in the second part.
Absolutely.
And just, he's another, like a Frank Welker. He's like a young Frank Welker, where you need something done, D's your guy to go to, which I love the voice casting.
He's an extraordinary actor, and that he makes noises that shouldn't come out of a human being.
Yes.
You know, he somehow manages to do all of this, and you totally believe it all the time. Yes, like Frank Welker, who could make, you know, everything talk that didn't make any sense. But it's just extraordinary that, again, for somebody like me coming in, you know, I started writing animation in the 80s, and my first jobs were on Disney's DuckTales and Gummy Bears and stuff. And so I'm seeing people like June Foray, you know, in the booth. And I'm saying to myself, that's my childhood. And so I'm just blown away every time there's an opportunity to watch a performance. Anyway, I don't want to fanboy too much. We have a lot to cover, but it's kind of a dream come true to be able to do this for a living. I'm very fortunate. I know
we will actually revisit that conversation, because we always ask the guests how they got to where they are. You know, like, what was your journey from, and did you always want to do animation? So we can cover that a little bit later. But I know the fans are so interested in, how did you get the gig? You know, that kind of thing. Like, how did you end up in that writer's room writing this episode? So we can save that for a little bit, but we definitely want to touch on that later.
Okie doke. Whatever.
I'm
happy.
Some of the questions I had was, I loved when the reveal that we get when, you know, Rex is first knocked unconscious in the chamber. I love the updated, I want to say that too, I love the updated origin, because this was not Metamorpho's comic book origin. And I was curious, let me start with that. His comic book origin was originally, he was changed by a meteorite found in a cave. And I was curious, did you come into this with preconceived notions about here's how it is, or was that kind of laid out for you already? And did they say, hey, Len, update the origin. Here's what we have. Here's what we want. How is your hand in creating the origin for Rex that we see in the episode?
Well, again, this was a very long time ago in the latter Bronze Age, so it's hard to remember every twitch or spasm. But I look back. I honest to goodness, I found a floppy disk and a way to read it, so I was able to look at most of the documents that came from this period, and I want to tell you. What's interesting is I have a series of premises that I pitched. And one was a very dark one with Dr. Light, who's a major baddie I think that was the Green Lantern world. Mm-hmm. And there was another one with time travel and Nazis, because, you know, they're all good to punch. And, you know, all that sort of thing. And one of the things in, I think, the third pitch document was the Metamorpho story, the very earliest version with, you know, some changes. And eventually, I guess through lots of massaging with the help of Rich Fogel and Stan Berkowitz, we ended up with basically the story that you, you know, are familiar with from watching the episode. I don't know at what point we went from the comic book version to our version. I think it was probably to make it less happenstance and to make Stag the cause of all this trouble. Stag is a great villain. And by the way, again, with Dan Reba and all the board artists and the character designers, that is comic accurate. The way the characters are depicted was like brilliant. They could have, you know, mucked about with it and turned it into something that was closer to the style. But that looks like the comic books I read when I was a kid.
Yeah.
And so look at how wonderfully smart and skillful they are to do that, to have Simon Stag with the bushy eyebrows and the weird hair and the whole thing. Just so smart. Really, really brilliant. Anyway, I digress. At some point or another, probably very early on in the process, it became clear that we had to make Metamorpho more of the victim of his boss, rather than in an early version. I think he was more of a fixer and not a very nice fellow, but we sort of ended up softening it and making him, too smart by half, kind of full of himself fellow, but not a bad guy. And eventually, you know, he really was subjected to horrible things by the boss. And we all know the real reason he did it. You know, he was looking for a guinea pig. But then when he found out that his daughter, who, let's say he had an unnaturally close relationship with her, unlike any person in the public eye currently, it was a little awkward, to say the least, but great fun to write. And then you have a motivation for Stag to say, okay, he's the guy who's going to be turned into the purple monster. So anyway, I digress.
No, that was a great answer.
That is perfect.
And you can cut out the political parts if you want.
I don't think it was that political.
No, we're good.
You didn't specifically name anyone, so we're going to let that slide. We're going to leave that in.
Have we mentioned what Len is wearing?
No.
The audience won't see it, but
for
we really
of you
should
in
mention
our
it.
Our radio audience, I am, in fact, wearing a Green Lantern teen shirt because, you know, when you go to enough conventions, you sometimes buy stuff. And since I have to say, working on this was kind of a dream come true, because when I was reading comic books as a kid, my favorite character was the Green Lantern. Granted, it was Hal Jordan, but it was still the Green Lantern. I loved the idea of the ring and the willpower and all that stuff. There is a picture, a Polaroid or something like that, in a box somewhere of me at my 11-year-old birthday party, dressed as the Green Lantern. So that shows you that this was like, there's an echo. And I'm never going to show that in public, trust me. Nobody wants to see me in tights. But he definitely was, you know, my favorite character, as much as also Batman and Superman and Wonder Woman. You know, all the characters in the original Justice League comics, some of my earliest comics that I bought when I was a kid, it was the Justice League run in, was it Brave and the Bold?
Yeah, that was very early, very early, like second, third, fourth appearances.
Starro was in one of the issues, and there was a table, and I don't remember all of it now. And I sold those comic books because, you know, grow up. But, you know, at one point, I was a serious collector of DC comic books. I ended up writing mostly Marvel later, but, you know, I got a chance to do a little DC stuff, and so that was fun.
No, that Brave and the Bold, number 28, that's the first appearance of the Justice League, and then the second appearance of Amazo happened in Brave and the Bold 2 before they ever got their first official Justice League number 1 launch. So, yeah, that was some very cool stuff you had.
Wow, deep dive. Thank you for name-checking.
This is why he's the best co-host for me, because I don't know about that stuff, and he knows everything there is to know about all of it.
Yeah, that's you're a handy person to know for this.
He is so handy to have on this podcast with me.
If you ever need a partner at Trivia Night, Len, let me know if they're doing comic book trivia.
Okay. Fair enough.
Len, you mentioned Comic-Cons. Now, when you go to Comic-Cons, are you ever invited to be on panels?
Yes.
Okay.
I have been very fortunate. Subsequent to my run at Disney, we'll get into the whole history of me, but after I ended my time at Disney ended, one of the people I met at Disney had subsequently gone off, Eric Lewald, who ran the original X-Men series.
Yes, he did.
And
yeah.
So not long after I left Disney, I was able to do a soft landing in the X-Men world. I wrote 3 episodes for him on his extraordinarily successful series. And, so frequently, I will do panels about X-Men because they have a giant fan base.
Yes.
And occasionally, I can go in and talk about my career in general in terms of other shows, you know, what shows of the 1980s that you remember, kids. And we do those kind of panels, too. But a lot of the time, we end up at conventions, and I'm fortunate enough to be invited to, you know, be on these panels and discuss stuff. And it's always a pleasure. You know, you do this all the time, Susan. I think I saw you do a panel once. I know it was a Mark Evanier panel or something. But, you know, it's for those of us who are not, you know, instantly recognizable, it's always a pleasure because you get to see the people that are fans of the work, and they know it better than you do.
Yes, yes, they do.
You know, it's,
absolutely.
You know, in episode 260, you know, like, yeah, I'll have to look that one up. You know, I've written 260 some episodes of TV. Not all of them are going to register at this point, you know, because you some of them are for work. I mean, just for researching this thing.
Yeah.
I went back through some old diaries and pay stubs and things like that. And, you know, I'm seeing, okay, while I was working on, like, I don't know, Static Shock or maybe it was the early Ben 10s, I was also doing episodes of Dork Hunters from Outer Space. So I kid you not. not at the top of your viewing list. But, you know, when you're a freelancer like me and many of my contemporaries, you're glad to have a job and you see if you can find something amusing to say, whatever the show is. And so, yeah, you know, you just, it's a juggle. I'm sure you've heard from other writers. It's like, you know, we're all on the roller coaster trying to figure out, okay, who's paying the mortgage this month? And so,
well, and that's not just writers, you know, the directors, the actors, all of us, you know, all of us are freelance.
But the staff model, you know, certainly for actors, I can't imagine there was anything where you've been asked to, you know, just be on hold and, you know, it's an episode by episode thing, right?
Yes.
And for most writers, I mean, I was on staff at Warner Brothers for a little while. I was on staff at Disney, a couple of other places. But for most of us, it's just, you know, we're all sort of doing the juggle, you know, riding the roller coaster, you know. for those who are listening who aspire to be in the entertainment business, just be advised that it's not easy. It's great fun. It can sometimes be heartwarming, and it can sometimes be heartbreaking. Mm-hmm. And so you just sort of you have to have a thick skin, and tenacity. I'm a 10-year overnight success before I before I, you know, things started happening on a regular basis, you know, and we can talk about that too at some point. But anyway, so yeah, but if you're lucky enough to be able to do anything creative for a living for a while, it's a big deal. You know, there are a lot of people who want to do it, and there are fewer who get to do it. I mean, when I think of the cast of this show and others, the extraordinary talent, it's a small group of people, really, and that you are all in there and providing such wonderful performances. It's kind of amazing that we're all, you know, given the privilege to be to entertain. And so to bring it back to, again, a digression, to bring it back to what you were saying before, when I go to these conventions, it's like, you know, in our sitting alone in our room, we say to ourselves, oh, well, you know, we're in the ephemera business. We're a disposable like Kleenex. You know, it's a thing. And then you go and you say, you hear from somebody, they come up to do, you know, sign something or whatever. And you say, they say, thank you. And the phrase, I'm sure you've heard a million times, thank you, you made my childhood.
Yes.
And you, the glib response is, my condolences. But the actual thing is, it's touching.
Yes.
And humbling, because somebody says that what we do mattered to them. And I, you know, I mean, we've heard stories about people, especially with the X-Men and what that meant to people. It's just like, oh my goodness, how is it that, you know, we got so lucky to do something that to us was a job and a fun job, but to them was like, it was a safe haven. It was sometimes a life raft, you know? Wow.
Yeah.
So, you know, it kind of makes us, you know, it certainly beats digging dishes. I mean, digging ditches or washing dishes. I apparently can no longer speak.
Washing ditches, though, that's the worst job. Trying to wash a dish. Oh, come on.
The hose and the mud. And nobody wants that. So, yes. Well, anyway.
Can you imagine your 11-year-old self if you had told your 11-year-old, like, you know, sit back because in so many years you're going to be writing these characters.
Well, that's the interesting thing. You know, when I started writing, and I keep touching back to, you know, origin story, but when I started writing, I had my first sale, you know, it's when I wanted to be a writer, I was figuring this out in high school. And my advice also is, don't let a 17-year-old decide what you should do for the rest of your life. Unless, of course, that's the only thing you know how to do. And then, yeah, go for it. But that really, I mean, my first script was a Star Trek in sixth grade for an English class. So, you know, I wanted to be a writer before I knew I wanted to be a writer. You know, I had no other skills. So, of course, I had to do this. You know,
but the fact that you had that passion at such a young age and it never wavered, I think that says everything, because we all have these fantasies about I'm going to be this, I'm going to be that. But then we settle into something, right? And for you to have that initial idea for yourself and then it just kept being there and nurtured, I think that's pretty extraordinary.
And you know, and I pursued it in high school. I was doing student films and writing musicals. And in college, I was already writing, you know, spec sitcom scripts. And my project one at UCLA was a musical. And that was The Road Not Taken, by the way, the Broadway career. That wouldn't have happened.
Interesting.
And I got a chance to throw a few songs into some of the early cartoons. So basically that's one of those. Yes. And you would also like to, you know, pay your bills. Don't go that way. So I ended up doing other things instead. But anyway.
So was Broadway or musicals?
Writing songs, you know, just because it's. Again, I'm writing plays and musicals in high school. I'm hearing people laugh and applaud, and I say, well, of course, that makes me feel better. Sure. I should do that for a living. That was a fun thing. But I had a knack for writing, you know, silly dialogue fairly early on. And so
for animation, like, did you?
Oh, no.
Or for live action.
I was a precocious sitcom writer. My first sale, I was a junior at UCLA in the film school, and I had my first assignment freelance assignment on a sitcom no one remembers called Holmes and Yo-Yo, a 13-week wonder on ABC. Two cops, one of whom was a robot. But it was by the guys who had done Get Smart, so I was sitting...
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, and I was sitting with people were comedy gods for me. And, of course, I did a terrible job because I was 20, turning 21, and I did not know what I was doing. And so that's too bad. But it was my first job, and it was good. And then the next year, I had a TV series format option. I came up with an idea. There was a pitch to a guy who later went on to do Saved by the Bell, named Peter Engel, but he was running a TV division of a company called First Artists. And I pitched him and had optioned a sitcom about the first black president of the United States. Like that could happen. But that was 1977, so I was a little ahead of my time. Anyway, so I'm graduating college. I say to myself, hey, this is going to be easy, right? Look, I have two sales before I get out of school. And then there was 3 years of radio silence. And then we can talk about why the 10-year process, really, for most of us, it takes a long time to end up doing something. And
well, while we're there, why don't you just continue? Because I think it's so fascinating. I love this. It's great.
Fair enough. Thank you. For those who have heard me speak on other podcasts, apologies for the repetition, but I've only got one origin story and I'm sticking with it. But the whole thing with the basket in the river and the log cabin, I can't do any of those. But anyway, So I bumped around for a long time, wanted to be a sitcom writer from the very beginning. The dream of watching four cameras dance on a soundstage on a Friday night, that was all I wanted to do. I went to film school with a bunch of guys who wanted to write the screenplay to change the world. I ended up writing on 24 and other shows like that, which is a great living. I'm not knocking it, by the way. But I wanted to be a sitcom guy. And I had a few sales, some options, yada, yada. And then, ended up writing industrials and corporate shows, the wonder and the glory of Nissan cars and Mitsubishi televisions when Mitsubishi was making TVs. And so one of the mom and pop companies doing these industrials, the pop of the mom and pop company was Michael Rye, an old radio voice actor who was the voice of Duke Igthorne on The Gummy Bears.
Oh, okay.
So Michael introduced me to a story editor named Jim Magon, who was a story editor on The Gummy Bears. And I got a chance to write one freelance gummy and one freelance DuckTales, where no duck has gone before. Guess what? Star Trek is a recurring theme in my aspirations as well. So then Disney was ramping up, with DuckTales. And then it became the Disney Afternoon, which was this giant block, 65 episode series, 5 days a week on syndicated TV. Like, there's no such thing anymore. But anyway, so they were hiring people left and right, and I was one of the people they hired. So I ended up on staff there for 5.5 years and worked on DuckTales and Tailspin and all that. And okay, talk about fork in the road career wise. Like I say, I wanted to be a sitcom writer. Oh boy, did I. But I had met a couple of story editors on the picket line at the Writers Guild 85 picket, I think it was, and when we were on strike then. And 2 weeks after I signed my contract at Disney TV Animation to go on staff, I get a call from them asking about my availability. But oh no, being the Boy Scout I am, or was, except I was never a Boy Scout, but I said, oh no, I've signed a contract. And that was the fork in the road. That's when I, the aspirations as a sitcom writer went one way and the steady income as a writer in animation went the other. And it you know what? On balance, it all worked out fine because one, the show that they were on was the CBS version of Charles in Charge. So I never got a chance to work for Scott Baio. And two, had I been a middling sitcom writer, and let's face it, there's only so many Phil Rosenthal's and Chuck Lorre's in the world, I would have aged out by 40, because that's what happens in that. Mm-hmm. Your hair goes gray, you're no longer funny. So I got my use-by date was extended by decades by working in animation. And I got to write a lot of fun shows, and I got to work with some really talented people. So all in all, I made a nice middle-class living as a working slob writer. Never one of the big cheeses, but got a chance to do fun stuff. So, and I got to be a writer. So on balance, it all worked out. Anyway, so ended up, you know, working with a lot of great people, as I said. Alan Burnett was one of them.
Oh, yeah.
I worked when we were all at Disney TV Animation. And so when he went over and was on Batman and Superman and all that while I was still at Disney. And eventually, although I never got a chance to work for Batman, the animated series, he did start hiring me to work on Static Shock. And so I did 16 or so of those, both as a freelancer and as a staff writer and story editor and freelancer again. And that's where I met, you know, people like Stan Berkowitz. And Rich Fogel had been my story editor on the Gummy Bears. So that shows you how far back we go. I know, old home.
I love it.
And so Dwayne, of course, the great late Dwayne McDuffie, you know, we all miss on a daily basis, had seen what I had done with his character on Static Shock. Static. You know, he had co-created that. And so several years later, when he finally finished on Justice League Unlimited and then went over to redo the reboot of Ben 10, he hired me, and all in, I did 24 Ben 10s in three series. Two of the series for Dwayne and one for his widow, Charlotte, and his best friend, Matt Wayne. So I got a chance to work directly with him, which had not been the case really in my brief time on Justice League. But, you know, I got to meet him and, you know, look up to him literally and figuratively.
Uh-huh.
And so, you know, that was a wonderful opportunity and education because, well, Dwayne, as you know, was an honest-to-God genius,
mm-hmm.
smartest man you could ever imagine, and a brilliant writer. And so I learned a lot from him. You know, I think I'm pretty good at my job, but I learned a lot from him, working for him on the Ben 10 shows. Because, boy, smart and determined to, you know, again, I got a chance to work for people like him, and Alan Burnett and people who are willing to push the envelope, tell stories that don't fit into the let's have an explosion every 12 minutes or everybody after the treasure or whatever. And that's what these guys did. They gave us an opportunity and fought fiercely for that opportunity so that we could tell stories that were about the human condition, because in the end, that's what we all want to do. We want to tell stories that affect us, that affect us. And therefore, we hope by extension, affect the people who are seeing what we write.
Can you talk a little bit about where it says story by you and teleplay by Dwayne, what that collaboration, if you will, what that experience was like? What can you explain who did what in all of that?
Yeah, I can. Well, here's what happened. And, you know, apparently this had been erased from the old, you know, memory block. But I was on staff at Warner Brothers and had been working on Static Shock, and I think we were between seasons on that, so I got a chance to write, finally, for Justice League, which was a wonderful opportunity. And it so happened that I started work on the Metamorpho Beats, was my first note in my diary, June of 2001, with Stan Berkowitz going over the beats and fleshing it out. And my first story outline was July 5th, and then in August, my contract ran out at Warner Brothers.
Oh.
So, years of therapy. So I finished my teleplay, the first part, and I think that was all she wrote on my, having written the story, then Dwayne picked it up and, of course, did a better job than anybody else could have done, and did part two. And so that's what happened. And now, just so it isn't all poor me, I continued to write freelance for Static and then Ozzy and Drix, which was great fun.
Yes.
And other shows, you know, for other people. And then, you know, again, for my friend Eric Lewald and other story editors. And I was writing on some Marvel stuff. And anyway, so it all worked out, and I continued to work as a freelancer. And then, maybe 5 years after that, I began writing for Dwayne after he had finished on Justice League and at Warner Brothers and went over to Cartoon Network. So I think it was about April or so, maybe earlier than that, of 2007, that I started working on Ben 10 Alien Force. Hmm. And so it goes. So, I've been lucky in that for a long time I got to be a working freelancer, working well enough to make a living at it, you know, because so many people, especially the younger writers that I'm chatting with these days, it's so hard. There are so many, there are a lot of shows, but it's so hard to get on any one of them. And certainly the staff model has evaporated in most cases. And right. It's a real battle to earn a living. I heard some statistic not long ago that most of the members of the local 839 have been in the Animation Guild for about 5 years. And the usual lifespan, I heard Billy Ray on his podcast that he recently concluded, the lifespan of a Writers Guild member on average is 7 years.
Wow.
The fact that I've been doing this 37 or 38 years in one form or another, I am a statistical anomaly. I've never made a fortune, but, you know, making a living, a middle class living in Los Angeles. Wow. Good luck, right? Good luck to the young people who are trying to do the same thing. Now, you really have to have a uranium mine in the backyard to be able to keep you through the lean times. Mm-hmm. It's a terrible battle. And, you know, obviously, Susan, the work that actors have trying to make a living, you know, where they used to get top of show, they're lucky to get, you know, sort of a baseline minimum income. Mm-hmm. And oh gosh, don't even get us started with the whole AI conundrum. But you know, it's just it's not a nice thing to do to yourself.
I think that should be on your business cards if you have them going forward. Len is Len Yulee, statistical anomaly. I think that's
yes. yes.
Good point.
I'm a math error is basic. Yeah.
I was looking back, and again, knowing that Dwayne did part of this too, I'm just curious if you can fill in any of this, because this was in the first part. I love the reveal that we get of Rex after the accident. He's looking around and we see it from his eyes, and it immediately reminded me of the Twilight Zone episodes where they used to have the reveal. And then again, when he lands in front of the TV shop and his face is all over the TV screens, it's very Twilight Zone driven. Being you wrote for, you know, Star Trek and everything in your brain, were you a fan of the Twilight Zone series, and did that kind of spring from that for you?
Of course. Now, I must, you know, I don't think we have time, but I should go back in the file and see if that's my handiwork or if that's something that Dan and his board team did. I, off the top of my head, I do not remember, but I'm assuming it was mine, but I could be wrong. It could be I might have had a different gag in there, and they did it. I can't tell you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, had I looked ahead, I would have remembered that, but I didn't read every draft because, frankly, you know, who has time? But yeah, it's entirely possible that could have been me or somebody else.
But it's amazing that you still got all the notes from that. I'm just the way you're like, here, look at my notes. I don't think we've had anybody on the show yet who's literally referenced, well, here's the notes I had in my journal and this. That's amazing that you've got that still.
Well, okay. If you look this way, that cabinet contains a bunch of, I kid you not, floppy disks.
Oh, wow.
You know, and most of them, by the way, not most of them, but some of them, I can't even read anymore. The software that they were written on is so old that it's like, oh, good luck trying to decipher that. That's the problem. You know, paper, that doesn't go away.
Sure.
But every magnetic medium goes, and then we're all in trouble. You know, just think of all the photographs you've got of your friends and family on your computer.
Yes.
One short circuit and there goes your personal history.
Yeah.
And we live in a talk about ephemera. We live in a temporary society in terms of our, what was the phrase? Our historical record,
mm-hmm.
You know, from Galaxy Quest.
Yes. Yes. Great movie. Great movie.
Yeah. Great movie. One of the best Star Treks ever made. Yeah.
It wasn't a Star Trek, Susan. That you've got the look on your face. I was just curious if I needed to geek that one for you.
No, I could tell by his delivery. I'm like hip to his delivery now. Okay. I knew that wasn't actually.
All right.
Yeah.
But thanks, thanks for the save, Gene.
No, I just want to make sure. We had obviously whenever we do these podcasts, we love to get the listener feedback and the audience involved. And we had a lot of questions from the audience on this one for the questions for Len when we said we're going to have you on the show. We had this person I know has asked questions before, Joseph MP4 with a zero for the O in Joseph. Who wrote the A Toast to Java, Unbridled Capitalism line? I know you addressed that directly on Twitter, but that's just that line stood out to me. Was that something was that all you? Was that any input from anybody else?
I believe that was me because, you know, like I say, a delicious villain, a terrible, terrible human being. Simon Stagg is great. That kind of villain is great fun because, you know, he believes he's doing the exact right thing, usually for profit, but he's, you know, such a megalomaniac, again, like nobody we know in public sphere right now. But, you know, just somebody who thinks that everything he does is right and to hell with everybody else. And, the bottom line is the only line that matters for him. There were two things in this episode that were a real kick for me. One of them was writing that character because, you know, creepy and greedy and all those things. And the other thing was, there was a gag in it that Green Lantern slices a truck in half.
Yes.
And I have always wanted to do that bit. And, you know, an argument could be made, well, you could have done anything else to prove that he was distracted, but I had to do that gag. And it turned out very well. Again, Dan and his team, great production values. So, you know, I was like, okay, mission accomplished. That's off the checklist. I'm okay now. Yeah, I got a chance to write Green Lantern twice, one here and one in The Batman, which Alan Burnett ran years later at Warner Brothers. And I did. There was a Green Lantern crossover episode, and I think it was Dermot Mulroney. Who played Hal Jordan in that and played him as a bit of a jerk. And it was fine, which is how it was written. And so I've got my two Green Lanterns taken care of, so I can. I can go quietly into the night, the darkest night, I guess.
Who wrote the line, "Fasten your seatbelts, it's going to be a bumpy ride," and are you an All About Eve fan?
Well, you know, part of the pop culture, you know, are you a fan of movies from the 30s and 40s? Generally, I am. You know, my idea of fun would be to write a new Thin Man movie, but nobody's asking me to do that kind of stuff. The idea of witty repartee among sophisticated people, you know, that's my idea of a fun time.
Well, but if you ever do get to write it, please hire me to actually voice one of the characters, because that's my idea of a good time.
You betcha. You know, that's the thing. It's kind of a lost art, you know, to do a sophisticated. I mean, there are rom-coms. God knows the Hallmark people. You know, I'd be happy to write a Hallmark movie, by the way. But, you know, it's not the same kind of thing. You know, when you see, you know, like Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, that's the patter. That's the speed with which comedy dialogue should be said by my lights. But, you know, there are very few people who know how to do it, and even fewer who get a chance to do it. So,
yes,
I aspire to that sort of thing. Instead, I write for Talking Ducks, you know.
but James, I'm sure you have other questions, but I have to say I laughed out loud when I saw that you worked on The New Adventures of Winnie the Pooh, and your one of the episodes was Paw and Order.
Yes, and Jim Cummings played the villain and did it with a Jack Nicholson kind of voice.
Oh,
and it was really fun. And again, a brilliantly produced one. Carl Gears was the producer director on that. Carl's gone now, sadly. Carl did a great job, and all of the art team on, again, this was Disney, the high watermark for Disney TV animation too. It's a beautiful series that they did. And so, yeah, I got a chance to write one Winnie the Pooh. And it was a real romp. It was a Western. It was very silly. And the villain's name was Nasty Jack. And so, in a while, you get to do stuff.
What joy.
You can watch. And, you know, it lasts. And I have a book on a shelf somewhere that there was a children's book version of that. So, you know, it's something you can really put your hands on. You know, so, I got a chance to write some silly bits. And if you want to talk, I'm going to put in a plug for some people that you probably haven't interviewed or maybe should. There's a guy I've worked with several times named Rob Hoagie, and he produces such gorgeous shows. I did a couple episodes of a Thunderbirds Are Go reboot that he supervised out of Britain and New Zealand, special effects by Peter Jackson's company down in New Zealand.
Oh, wow.
It was CG characters in practical sets, and it was fantastic. And then he more recently did a show called Stillwater, a beautiful preschool show. So if you get a chance to watch some of these things, I highly recommend it because, you know, when you see a lot of people say, oh, it's just cartoons. But then you see production values like with Justice League, like with some of the early Disney stuff, like the stuff I just mentioned. You say to yourself, well, this is high art. This is something that is really good, solid, you know, will last forever kind of entertainment. Mm-hmm. And that's the stuff you can be proud of. Because, you know, it does have longevity. It's not that any of us get any back end from it because, you know, we write animation, but it's lovely to see. So
yes,
you can point to these things with pride.
And James, did you have more questions?
I'm sorry. Yes,
no,
I ran off with the show, James. It's back to you.
No worries at all. No, this is great because you are the person, the fans and the listeners are here to hear from, so that's fine. We did
exactly.
have a question from Matthew Barberio. Hopefully I pronounced that right, Matthew. He wants to know, was it ever considered to either keep Metamorpho's fate ambiguous or to have him actually make the ultimate sacrifice for the woman he loves, making the story even more tragic? Were there several different endings discussed, or was this one always the one that everyone had settled on?
It's so funny because if this were live action, you know they would have originally gone for he does make the sacrifice, and the studio would have said, no, we need it to have a happy ending.
And similarly, I did look back through the earlier drafts just to see heads and tails and see that in an earlier version of the Outlawn, yeah, he died. He was gone. And then cooler heads prevailed in case they ever wanted to bring him back.
Yeah.
More easily. And, you know, and they did have a happier ending. I mean, you know, Simon Stagg, you know, who knows what loony bin he's in after having mind melded with that big green goopy thing.
Mind meld.
But, he did come back. And why those decisions were made, I lost again in history. But that was the decision, and probably a good one because, mm-hmm. you know, again, we are doing entertainment, and it is a show for young viewers, so, you know, killing a lot of people all the time probably doesn't go over that well, you know, when you're trying to watch it and explain to a six-year-old, no, well, that character's done. I mean, there was a character that they killed in the first episode of the X-Men series.
And yes, Morph.
He was dead. So Morph, he was completely dead until they did some, screenings, and the most popular character was the one that got killed. So they had to bring him back. You know, the Fox kids said, you know, that guy, second round. So, you know, sometimes there are decisions made that have nothing to do with the integrity of the story and something to do with the fact that they, you know, somebody has a bright idea.
And much like Harlequin, Morph was exclusively created for the TV series. He did not exist really in the comic books before that. So that's very cool how they kind of made that crossover into mainstream.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, well, Harley Quinn, my God, what an extraordinary thing from a character who was a one-off.
Right.
And yes. How she's a movie star.
Yeah, yep. Exactly. Yeah. We had some
and
other
a
questions.
TV star.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah, TV, movies, everything. Absolutely. We had some other questions, but we kind of already addressed them. So Girl with Cello had asked, what inspired you to be a writer? We covered that. Did you read comics growing up? Covered that. And she said also, thank you for all your wonderful work and for coming on our show. We had Dylan Pollock is on Twitter at Steely Dill asked if you could have added Flash Jean, which Jean was in it, or Wonder Woman of the episode, what would you have them do? But I'm not sure if that was even something that you were like, hey, I'd love to have Flash do this, or if it was, no, here are the players you get, use these pieces.
Well, I would have put in a musical number, but, you know, time to practice. No, think about it, though. I mean, yes, you always want to say, oh, I love that character, I want to use this character. But you also have to, you know, there's just economies of scale. We introduced four new characters. We had to, and in my first half, we had to establish them and know who they were and what the interpersonal dynamics were on that. So to do that with, you know, Stagg and Java and his,
Sapphire.
Gosh. Sapphire, thank you. Sapphire and Rex Mason. It's like, okay, you got to give them time to breathe a little. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it would have been great. Yes, and yes, John did show up in part two, but not Wonder Woman, and I'm sorry. But, you know.
It makes me so appreciative of those episodes where we were all together, because it doesn't happen that often. And so I just feel this renewed gratitude for when we got to really be an ensemble and all be together in the studio, which I remember vividly.
The thing I miss, and I guess it's like, okay, well, maybe that's just the way it is now. The things that from the beginning of my animation writing career, they got all the actors in the room, mm-hmm. you know, the guest stars and the, you know, recurring cast, and everybody could perform together and feed off one another and laugh. It was so, I mean, to sit down and across the glass, you have people like, I don't know, just to name two, Rob Paulsen and Maurice LaMarche, you know, and as soon as like somebody like Rob walks into the room, you're laughing. It doesn't mm-hmm. matter. It's just hilarious. And then they do stuff. And what you and all of your colleagues did on Justice League, it's just to see that happen. And now everything's kind of, you know, everybody comes into the room one at a time. That's my understanding of it, Susan, you can elucidate. Do you ever have ensemble recordings anymore?
I have done, but most of the work I've been doing lately has been video games. So I'm alone. So
just you. Yeah.
Just me. Yeah. Which is not as, you know, as enjoyable, but it just is what it is. And it's always been that. I mean, for as long as my career, I think my first video game I ever did was an ensemble. We were all together and that never happened again.
I got to write one AAA video game. It came out just as COVID hit, called Rocket Arena. And it was great fun working on that lovely company up in Washington State. Which was released by EA Originals. And it was a real fun show, and we brought in a lot of, you know, the usual suspects.
Yes.
For the voice acting. And, yeah, it was one at a time. And, you know, these were all really top-notch people. But, again, because of the sort of clippy nature of video games, there's not a lot of interpersonal.
Right. Interaction, right? There isn't.
Yeah, so it's just one guy saying something clever and another person, you know, growling or snapping or throwing up or something like that. So, you know, it's not
a living.
It's a fabulous living.
But it's a living.
Yeah. So say we all, right?
Right.
It is a different kind of writing, but I do. You know, I would love to do more of them. It's a great gig, and God knows those are incredibly successful makers for the company that make them. But anyway,
we're coming up. Yeah, we're coming up on the end of our time. We don't want to keep too much longer. It's always great to get the writers and the directors' viewpoints, because as Susan said in the very beginning, you guys are the unsung heroes. You worked on this, and you never get you're not the face of the franchise as Susan and Phil and George and all the others are. If people do want to find out.
I would argue that we're the voice of the franchise, not the face. I mean, I think like a Gal or, I think they're the faces of the Ben Affleck when he, you know, they're the faces.
That's
but
true.
I think we're the voices of the franchise.
Point well taken.
Yeah.
Point well taken. But if people want to keep up more with you, Len, do you have are you active? I know you're pretty active on Twitter, social media handles, websites, things like that.
Just the Len Uhly at Twitter on Lenuhly is my handle, if that's the word for it, on Twitter. Facebook is for my family, so no, I'm not putting that out there. And I stalk but do not use Instagram. I should learn how. Basically Twitter is it, you know,
okay.
And LinkedIn if anybody's offering a job, you know.
Oh.
So, Good for that.
Good to know. Good to know. You have to put that out there.
Yeah, because the future is always one is always looking for new work. You know, it's just that kind of thing where the freelance world is like I say, it's riding the roller coaster. So if anybody sees this or hears this, I should say, and says, you know, gosh, that Len, he wrote my childhood. I should hire him. I would say yes, you should.
Duly noted.
Yeah, why not? It never hurts to ask, you know.
Certainly
well, this
not.
May be this may be the fastest hour we've had.
It just flew by. Maybe
it was such a joy hearing your stories and hearing your insights. And I thank you for doing this with us because it's our pleasure. It truly is. So thank you for being here with us.
You're very kind, and it was a pleasure to chat with both of you. And I can rattle on at great length, but I won't. And I do appreciate the opportunity to do so with you folks.
Thank you.
And this, I'm going to edit this part out, but obviously, Len, I'm going to have you on my show in just a couple weeks on my actual radio show. That radio show will air before this episode drops, just because it's all wibbly wobbly timey wimey the way the things have worked out. So in case you're wondering why I didn't promote you being on my radio show later this month, it's because this episode here will drop well after you've been on my show.
Time has no meaning. We discovered that during COVID.
You know, I love that you're going to be on his show. It's so much fun.
Well, thank you. I appreciate the second invitation. That's very, very nice of you. I look forward to rattling on at length again.
Yeah, because there's so many stuff I wanted to ask you about now, but obviously I want this to keep it kind of blinders on Justice League focused, but I wanted to talk to you about X-Men and DuckTales and all those other things that I grew up watching, so that'll be great to delve into all that more, just the two of us. Hopefully Susan will tune in maybe and listen. I don't know if she pays attention.
Bring her on, doggone it. I love talking with you both. This is great fun.
Yeah, hopefully we can do it again, too. I know there's other stuff that we want to talk with you about. So if we'll just stay close by, because we'd love to bend your ear and have you on again.
I'm at your disposal. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you so much. Have a wonderful day and Happy New Year.
Yes. Belated Happy New Year to all you, too.
You
Thank
too.
Thank you.
Thanks very much again, Len. We appreciate it. There he goes, Len Yulee. That was fantastic. I love that he had like hard drives of notes and diaries of notes, because that's exactly the kind of stuff we want. I mean, I almost want to have him send me photocopies so we can put this out online for the fans to see, the handwritten notes and everything. That's so cool.
And I loved how he researched it before he came back on our show. Like, he was prepared. He did that dive into his own history to remember the show and the prep for the show and the writing of the episodes. I love that. And he's got wonderful stories. And, you know, he kept saying, well, I don't want to, you know, talk too much about this. And it's like, please, this is why we're doing this. We want to hear it. That was so much fun. What a lovely guest.
Yeah. And the fact that he was very flattering about the other people he's worked with, which I feel like, again, I've always said this in the past, Andrea really set the tone for, like, she would suffer no fools, as Tim Daly said. I feel like everybody who worked on Justice League, top tier, great people. I've never heard, well, this guy was kind of a jerk, from anybody, from the writers, directors, storyboard artists, sound engineers. Everybody was not only good at their job, but seemed to be good people.
I have to say, right? I mean, that really seems to be a theme that keeps emerging. And I mean, in my experience, That was my experience on the show. I mean, you know, it was just all these wonderful, brilliant, smart, passionate people. And I don't, like I've said so many times, I don't know why those people haven't been hired to do the live action, because I think you would have the biggest blockbuster ever. You're not going to find better in that industry than what we had in animation. You're just not.
No, and the stories we told, like I said, the fact that I'm familiar with the origin of Met. I actually own, I don't know if I have it in my collection anymore because I sold most of it, but I had the original Brave and the Bold number 57 from 1965, where Metamorpho first appears, and it's got the origin with Simon Stagg and Sapphire and Java and everything. And to Len's point, they did a great job in the Bruce Timm style of animation of still keeping the Simon Stagg look. Because when I grew up reading, I remember it was Justice League Europe, And we had an episode with Metamorpho where Simon Stagg was mad and wanted to take him out. He actually hires, at that time, the Green Lantern was Guy Gardner, who was the biggest jerk in the DC universe. He hires the Green Lantern Guy Gardner to take out Metamorpho for him. And if anyone who's reading right now, brilliant work. If you get to read that, it's hilarious. The Justice League group was very comedic, as was Justice League America at the time, the two series that kind of went down the line following the group titles for the superheroes. And it's such a fun book to read. So I love the fact that the Bruce Timm style art, to Len's point, stuck with the original look of Simon Stagg and Java.
It was very sweet during the interview too, because when you mentioned those really geeky things, his face kind of lit up that you had those references right there in your back pocket. You know, I don't know if you saw Len's expression, but he was like giddy. And whereas I was like, you know, nodding off, he was very excited. And, you know, I feel badly that in these conversations, I can't bring much to the table because I know what it is to feel passionate about a genre. And I just wish I could meet you halfway. But alas, I cannot.
But that's why we're such a good team, because you were in the room when all this stuff was going on, and you've got that insight and that kind of skill set that you bring about the doing the voices and the acting part of it and the storyboards and the ADR and stuff. And I'm just there with the quick little facts, like, fun fact, Simon Stagg first appeared in this issue on page 75. So that's why this makes such a good coupling here.
Okay, well, now I don't feel so bad. Thanks. You know, and I have to say, one of the things that was so special about that time was that when the celebrities were in the room, you didn't feel, I mean, maybe there were one or two exceptions with somebody like huge, but most of the time you just felt like an ensemble. And that's very rare in life. You're always aware, because everything's basically high school, even as adults. And there's always a hierarchy, even in a green room at a Comic-Con. You know, there are certain levels of celebrity and you're very aware of them all the time. But in these rooms, when we did these recordings, I think a lot of people were vulnerable. A lot of the celebrities, they'd never done animation. So they came in and there wasn't an arrogance with any of them. And it just makes me so appreciative of that time and those rooms, because I don't think we have them quite like that anymore.
Yeah, and so, we kind of mentioned that too, the demise of the ensemble cast recordings, which is very sad. I know for all of you, it does make a difference to me per se, because as an end user or consumer of the product, I have a hard time telling whether or not you did this on your own in a studio with ADR if you were in the group. So, but as your point of view, I can see it being a real loss.
It's huge. And, you know, one of the rules of doing it is you're not allowed to overlap with another actor. So as natural as it is to have overlaps in conversation, we talk over each other all the time, you and I mean, and I, you know, and that's just natural. But that was a big no-no. We were not allowed to do that. And so, the benefit was just being in the room and having a rehearsal with everybody. It was just, if you lose that, you lose a lot. But I think everything now is also so remote. So people are recording from their homes in a different state. They're not even in LA necessarily.
If they're in the country sometimes.
Right, right. So anyway, just as an aside, it made me think about that and that lost time, because, you know, what a gift we had. And I really appreciated him saying that people come up to him and say that he was part of the childhood, because that is what we get all the time. And it is humbling, and it never gets old hearing it ever.
I can imagine. So, yeah. And it's one of the things I love going to these conventions, because I get to meet all these fantastic people like yourself and like Len and everyone who are at these conventions. It's always a lot of fun. We're coming up to the end of the first season of Justice League. We're wrapping this up. We've only got, I think, one episode left, which we're going to cover here in the coming weeks. So those of you listening, stay tuned, because we're going to go into season two. Trust me, we're not doing a season one and done. But I'm excited for the end of this season and looking forward to starting season two of Justice League. But I've just enjoyed the rewatch, the slow ponderous rewatch of this at my leisure, just really absorbing it in a way I never did before. And I'm assuming it's the same for you, because you say you pick up on stuff you missed the first run through all the time.
Oh, gosh. I mean, and also just the time lapse. I mean, it's been so long. And while there are certain episodes I know really, really well, there are some I haven't seen in, I mean, this episode, for instance. And it was just such a treat. And again, shout out to Dan Reba and his team, because my God, making all those words and those images come to life in this episode. I was so struck by it. And that's what Len started off saying. You know, he couldn't get over it. And it's been a joy. I can't wait for the second season. I have loved doing this podcast with you more than I could have imagined. I knew I'd like it, but I never thought I'd love it as much as I do.
Yeah. And same for me. I look forward to this every time we get to record. I get a little tingle in my stomach, and it's always a lot of fun. For people who maybe, I always say this might be someone's first episode. This might be the download. They're like, oh, there's a Justice League podcast. So they may be listening to this for the first time. So let everyone know if they want to find you, if they want to interact with you and keep up with you, website, social media handles, things like that.
Yes. So it's easy, because I'm Susan Eisenberg, and then the number one on pretty much every social, all social media. And then my website is SusanEisenbergVoice.com. So it's pretty easy, right? I mean, I'm findable.
Yeah, I would say so. And you're very active and engaging with the fans, which is always a pleasure to see. So you're
shucks.
Adored by the multitudes. So
thanks.
And if those,
and what
you,
about you?
Yes.
How do people find you?
Yeah. So we do a live radio show every Sunday night at 10 o'clock Eastern, 7 p.m. Pacific. We always have guests from the world of pop culture. My show is called Geek to Me Radio. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram under those handles at Geek to Me, TOMERADIO .com is my website, geektomeradio.com. So you can go back if you want to hear if you're a Justice League fan, go to my website and you can click on the pictures of Susan or Kevin Conroy or George Newbern and listen to the other interviews I've done with them before we ever started this podcast. And you can follow me there. YouTube, we try to go live with video whenever Joey V, my producer, is in the studio with me. So you can find me on YouTube, Geeked Me Radio on YouTube. Please hit that subscribe button there so we can kind of extend our reach. And if you have the chance, this particular podcast, we're on Twitter, OG Justice League, all one word. And give us a follow there. But also, wherever you're listening to this podcast, as soon as you're done with this episode, click the button to leave us a 5-star review. Say a few nice words about something you enjoyed in this episode or the theme overall, because having that review helps push us up in the search engine optimization, or SEO, for those of you tech kids out there.
Wow, look at you.
So we appreciate that. Susan loves it when we get reviews. She always texts me and goes, oh my gosh, we got another review. Listen to this.
I do. It's very exciting to know that there are actually people. I mean, Len mentioned that he had listened to a few other episodes. So I love that. Makes me happy.
Yeah, it's always fun to hear. So we appreciate you supporting this podcast. And hopefully you will follow Susan and I on our other social medias. And we look forward to bringing you more episodes because, as Susan always says,
the conversation continues.